It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Oh, we're not afraid. Yeah, we're not afraid. We're not afraid, but maybe we should be. You know, there's a lot going on here in Arizona today, and we got a great guest for you. Let me tell you what's going on today. First, we're going to start with Josh Stieber. He was he's a soldier in Bravo Company that was documented in the video Collateral Murder. You know, that was a WikiLeak, the video of gunships laying waste to a lot of Afghanis and Iraqis and stuff. This was Iraq, and we have the Afghan WikiLeaks of a bunch of stuff there, and it's hard to keep, you know, the separate between, you know, it's all the same thing going on. You know, they may speak a different language, or they may, you know, wrap their turban from the left or the right or somewhere. They're human beings. And this is it's getting worse. And I saw a piece on Jon Stewart Daily Show last night, and we may play a little clip of that. But I want to get to Josh. He wrote a letter of reconciliation to the Iraqi people apologizing for whatever role he's had over there, because if he wasn't directly involved in that particular incident, he certainly knows what's been going on. Then in the second and third hour, we're going to talk about SB 1070. I had a call yesterday, and they hadn't even updated the law, because it doesn't take effect, you know, as of yesterday it didn't. I mean, it's just now starting to take effect, and there's all kinds of I'm sure if you're watching cable news, it's all over the place. And we had a lot of our activists down there. But there's an Al Jazeera radio is going to come in studio tomorrow, because they're like, you guys are the only ones that really understand what's going on, because they make it about, you know, I don't want to be deported. Oh, I want them deported. I don't want to be deported. I want them deported. And then there's a third leg out there going, you know what? This has nothing to do with immigration. It's about national ID. It's about all of us having to have our papers, please. And we'll go over the law, the actual law as it was passed. I did it on the morning show, and just read. You can't get past the first paragraph. I mean, you read this line by line, it'll surprise you. I don't think you really know what's really being done. And when they did the injunction, when the federal government sued and they went to the court and they said, you know what, from the contact an officer makes with an individual forward, we're saying none of that can be done for now. What was the other stuff? It was all about the accumulation of data, personal data, driver's licenses, photos. It's national ID. What do you think we've been telling you is going on? It takes foreign correspondents to go, we knew this. We've gone through this over in the Middle East all the time. These governments, it's the first thing they want to do. Well, we're trying to, you know, like, I don't know, export democracy or freedom or something in the name of, and we're using force and gunships around the world to saying we're against the very things that we're doing today in Arizona. Well, one of the gentlemen I want to talk to about this and his revelations as a young man going over and coming to grips with what he's done and what's happened, Josh Stieber. Am I saying that right, Josh Stieber?
No, it's Stieber.
Josh Stieber. Thank you. Go ahead and tell me what your position was at what time during this, and whatever it was. I mean, certainly it motivated you to write a moving letter to Iraq saying, look, man, you know, we're not all of us are bad. So I go ahead and tell us your story, would you please?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on the show. I was in the Army, in the infantry, and deployed to Iraq. from February of 2007 until April of 2009. And the video with the gunship incident that made it out through WikiLeaks happened in July of 2007 when I was there. And I wasn't on the particular mission that day, but I was in the same platoon and spent 14 months with the guys who are shown on the ground in the video. The helicopter was attached to our unit for that day, but the one I was with were the folks on the ground. And after I saw the video and started seeing a lot of the responses about it, I started realizing that people were, a lot of people were taking the stance that, you know, it was an isolated incident or that it was an example of a few soldiers gone wrong or something like that. But from my experiences and how I was trained in so many similar instances, and I think the more recent reports in Afghanistan collaborate that that this kind of thing goes on, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, on a fairly regular basis. And so even though I wasn't on the particular mission that day, I saw a lot of things like it, and I went through training that, you know, encouraged that kind of behavior, and myself and another veteran who is in that video felt the need to write the letter that we did.
Okay, this is the point that I want to make, and of course what I want to ask from you is that this was expected. I mean, from the beginning, before we even went into Iraq, I'm on the radio in 03 before we even went in. You know, I got Sam Donaldson on. I got Tony Snow on. I got all that G. Gordon Liddy on. They're like, oh yeah, we gotta go kill, 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 kill. And I'm wow. I knew what was going to happen. It was going to be the shock and awe. We're going to roll in with all the machines and everything we got to go do some butt whipping. And then we're going to have a Marine put his foot up on top of the rubble, holding an American flag, and say, we win, mission accomplished. And then the war was going to start. Then you're going to have people that aren't none too happy about having guys in every corner with M16 and roadblocking and, you know, searching houses and kicking in doors and violating their women and all this kind of, I mean, you know, sooner or later. And it was almost as if not only was it anticipated, not only was it certainly prepared for and you were trained for it, it's like they need it. These wars aren't meant to be won. They're meant to be fought and fought and fought. And I can't imagine they'll say, oh, there's 5,000 terrorists, and you go kill 5,000-10,000 people, and you just create another 500,000 terrorists. So I'm going, it's like it's a forever thing. And with this mindset, you know, one, you know, am I inaccurate in any way? I mean, does it seem this is kind of what was going on?
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, the way that you put it, I actually recently did a speaking tour with a man who's from Iraq who moved here from there a couple years ago, and when we were on tour, you know, people would ask him different questions about, well, you know, doesn't whatever justify the U.S. military being there, and the way he presents it almost makes it sound humorous, is that, you know, first we had to go there to get rid of Saddam, and then we had to go there to start implementing democratic elections. And then we were preventing the Civil War, and then we were waiting for the police force to get strong enough. And just, you know, every few months the reason would change, but the practices in a large part really wouldn't.
Okay, now you're over there, and it was expected that you would be brutal, or you just were allowed, or it just nobody cared, or get the job done. Were you on missions to where late at night you're kicking in doors going to people's homes?
Yeah, we were definitely kicking in a lot of doors. That was a common practice. I guess I would trace it back. I think a lot of it even traces back further than the military, just to a lot of cultural assumptions. Quick example is I remember in high school learning, you know, that things like the dropping of the atomic bomb during World War II wasn't a moral question but was a strategic question, and that, you know, sometimes it's necessary to take civilian life to accomplish your goals. So I think in a lot of ways, if we look deep enough in our own society, that is prevalent. And then, of course, it only gets escalated through through training. And you take a lot of people who however short-sighted, I think, wanted to try and do something positive. And the training that we went through was one that was very dehumanizing. We would have battle cries where we would yell things like kill them all, let God sort them out. And you start to, slowly transform somebody who's young and idealistic into kind of hardening over their conscience. And then they start introducing kind of the paranoia element. One piece of training that I went through was a couple weeks before we were
going. Let's go ahead and stop it right there. The training you went through a couple of weeks before you went in. Go ahead and remember where you're at. Would you for me, please?
Yes, sir.
Okay, let's go ahead and remember right where you are. We'll pick it up right where you left off, you know, because I don't want to miss anything and disturb your train of thought, but they're going to push the button on us here in a few seconds. So you guys hold on. I mean, we got a lot of good stuff for you today. You have someone that was there on the ground kicking in doors. And
it's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Dropping bombs, chemical gases filling lungs of little ones with ongoing suffering as the youth are young. So ask yourself, is the loving really gone? So I could ask myself, really, what is going wrong in this world that we living in? People keep on giving in, making wrong decisions, only visions of them dividends. Not respecting each other, denying thy brother. A war's going on, but the reason's undercover. The truth is kept secret, it's swept under the rug. If you never know truth, then you never know love. What's the love, y'all? Come on,
I don't know.
What's the truth, y'all?
Oh, where's the love? Well, I tell you what, it's right here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock. And if you can't have truth, you know, you can't have love. And I'm very appreciative that Josh Stieber is on the radio with us live trying to, I don't know, have some reconciliation. And he already tried, you know, a letter that he did along with Ethan McCord. And he wrote, we are both soldiers who occupied your neighborhood for 14 months. Ethan McCord pulled your daughter and son from the van, and when doing so, saw the faces of his own children back home. Josh Stieber was in the same company, but was not there that day, though he contributed to your pain and the pain of your community and many on many other occasions. And this, I mean, how long have you been out?
I got out in April of last year, so a little more than a year.
So this is, you know, you came to this realization after WikiLeaks came out. Were you feeling bad at the time? And we'll get back to your training where we left off. But I want to just, you know, at what point did you feel that you needed to try and come back to humanity? I mean, when was that? Was it before, while you were there, after, what?
I got to the point when I was still in Iraq towards the end of my deployment where I really was able to kind of break things down to this simple equation that of doing unto other people. And I realized that what I was doing on a regular basis, some of the things you mentioned of kicking in people's doors and just the things that we were normally doing, that if those things were done to me and to my family and my community, then I knew I wouldn't stand for it, and I knew I couldn't continue to do it to other people. So I applied as a conscientious objector right when I got back from Iraq, and 10 months later was released. And after that, spent 6 months walking and bicycling across the country trying to share my story and why I thought war wasn't working and trying to promote other ways of going about handling our differences.
You can't, but the military-industrial New World Order empire complex of is not going to be able to make money if you got peace. I mean, you know, they got motivations other than just getting along. And I'm sure you start to come to these kind of realizations, but in your end of the last segment talking about your training as you were going in, go ahead and tell me about that.
Yeah, so kind of mentioned some of the dehumanizing aspects of the training, and then they started to kind of incorporate paranoia on top of that. One training exercise we went through a couple weeks before we started doing patrols in Iraq was where some of the leaders in our unit would take the younger soldiers, including myself, into a room one at a time, and they would ask us a series of questions all leading up to the big question, which was if somebody in a marketplace full of unarmed civilians were to pull out a weapon, would you open fire on that person, even if you knew that you'd probably hurt or kill a lot of innocent people in the process? And if the answer to that question was not only a yes or anything other than a yes, but also it had to be an immediate yes, if it was anything different than an immediate yes, which it was for me, I hesitated, wasn't sure how to answer, and got yelled at and told that I was a horrible soldier and that hesitation was going to cost the lives of my friends and possibly myself, and that I better change my mindset. So you take the dehumanizing aspects of basic training and combine the paranoia elements of training like that, and then put people in a situation where we were under pretty regular threat, and it is a recipe for disaster.
Well, of course, I know the audience wants to know, were you responsible for the deaths of other people? Are you even willing to answer the question? You don't have to answer the question. You just rather not answer. That's fine.
Well, I've been asked the question before and might be a frustrating answer, but I guess the way that I've tried to look at it is I've really gone back and looked at what I stand for and what I value is of trying to transform myself from the inside out. And if I, listen to people who I have a lot of admiration for, going back to the religion I grew up with, if I look at somebody like Jesus, who essentially said that it doesn't even matter if you physically killed somebody, but if you even go around looking at people with hatred and judgment, then you're contributing to the problem. And I guess all that's to say that it can be easy to kind of pinpoint everything and say that only soldiers are responsible for death when it's a much larger system and so many things contribute to it. And I guess to make a brief analogy, it's like staring at the fangs of a beast and ignoring the rest of it. So I usually don't answer that question directly because I think it can take away from looking at, and including myself now that I'm out of that system, looking at different ways that I still contribute to the suffering that is creating around the world.
You know, I understand your point, and I'm hopefully we can make it even clearer for the audience. There is a training that goes kill, 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 and the paranoia they put in. Then you have people die around you. They're bringing in body parts of your friends and so on while you're in theater and so on. And I can see it gets. I remember it was the Black Hawk Down. I thought there was a scene in there that really encapsulated the emotion. Is like, you know, when the bullets start flying and all this stuff starts going, all of the philosophy and all the all that stuff goes out the window, and it's you're just trying to survive yourself and protect your friends from not dying, because that's your choice. Now, some people, even have the ability to make the choice. They just, stand up and take me out and I'm not playing or whatever. But I really don't put – when someone gets in that position, there's so many varying levels. And I'm sure that if not you, you certainly witnessed and you're trying to make your way back to humanity. Because I've seen – I'm 49, so I was too young to go to Vietnam. But my uncle did. He was a Marine. And there were other people that, as I grew older and years go by, and it's a decade, 15 years, 20 years later, they open up more, and you get more movies, you start reading more stuff, the stories start coming out. And it's all the same, throughout all the wars, is that as human beings, we have to be reconditioned and trained to take life and to be, callous for its loss. But then on our way back, we try and, regain our humanity, and we have to accept what happened to us and to the country and to others, and try and have some kind of catharsis or reconciliation in our minds, and try and, regain our humanity. And I can see that you're trying to do that. When we come back in the next segment, I want to hear from you more about that journey And there's, and we'll talk a little bit more about, you know, what happened in Iraq and you know, the people there. I'm wondering if you think that they will accept your apology, or they want something from you, or they just as soon put a, you know, bullet in your brain pan. So I'm, there's so many aspects of this. And in this break, I want you to go ahead and think about these things. But in just a minute that we got left here, can you, you know, go ahead over the music. You got, you know, like 10 seconds. Just give me one line of what you hope to accomplish by your mission and sharing time with me and others.
I guess the goal is to get people, hopefully more people, to recognize exactly what's going on over there and to put a human face on the people who go over there as soldiers and on the people at the other end of the gun also.
That's it. A human face. We'll be right back.
Rhodes? It's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
Yeah, what we fight for here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, Josh Stever from Iraq. A soldier that was with a company that was depicted in the WikiLeaks video of Iraqi children and men being gunned down. And, you know, he spent months with these guys as they come back from this mission and many others and many that he was involved in and was immersed in this. And he's trying to find his way back, you know, to humanity and the humanity that was lost there, not just lives lost, but, you know, pieces of our young men and women that are they ever going to be reclaimed? And in a letter he wrote, an open letter to Iraq, one of the paragraphs, there is no bringing back all that was lost. What we seek is to learn from our mistakes and do everything we can to tell others of our experiences and how the people of the United States need to realize what we have done and we are what we are doing to you and the people of your country. We humbly ask you what we can do to begin to repair the damage we caused. Has anybody responded to that? Are they saying, hey, I can tell you what you can do? Have you gotten any response?
Yeah, a couple days, I think it was, after the letter got published, the Times of London interviewed the mother of the children who were in the van shown in the video, and she said that she accepted the apology, and we were trying to talk to other members of the community, and it actually turned into a pretty complicated situation where the other members of the community thought that we were trying to kind of silence the family of the children in the van, and that definitely wasn't our intention at all. So we've stepped back a little bit from trying to do anything directly on that level because of the way things were going, and have instead been trying to form relationships with organizations that already have those connections, just because of how, you know, difficult it is to just you know, introduce yourself to a community after all those painful experiences. That's something that we're learning takes a lot of time.
Yeah, I know. We had a young woman that was in the Army. She got out conscientious objector, and she went back and as a non-governmental organization with a Muslim women thing, and she's not Muslim, but she dyed her hair dark and she got embedded with them and she went over, and she went up in Iraq and up in the area of Kurdistan, I believe, and she went and visited a village and they wanted her to tell their story. And after she had to go in through a minefield following a guy with one leg that had his leg blown off by a mine and lost two young sons to the mines, and they certainly were following him, go in, meet with the people, got some pictures of the fallout shelters and stuff they had built in the hills and such, and then they came out 2 hours later, it was a bombing raid and killed a bunch of people that they were talking to. We've talked to Iraq Veterans Against the War. You know, we've had a lot of people on the show about this, but I tell you, the one thing that I got from every one of them is that the casualties aren't just over there on the battlefield. They're walking here. They're the people that come back. And I'd like to ask, you know, the people that you served with, the people that were involved in this gunship damage, are they proud of what they did? Are they happy? Did they have any kind of remorse later? Or do you only get that out of theater? I mean, it had to have affected them in some way.
Yeah, well, in my experiences, the military definitely sends this message that what you're supposed to do is just your job and not to treat it as much more than that, and go and do it and don't worry about your conscience. And a lot of times people who go and seek help get criticized for it. Ethan, who co-wrote the letter, got really criticized for asking to go to mental health after the day shown in the video. And it, a lot of times, turns out to be the people who most think that their consciences don't exist, that it later catches up with them. After getting back from Iraq, before I got out of the military, there were several friends of mine who at one point or another ended up in a mental institution. Yeah, a lot of people, you know, respond to it in different ways. Some people turn to alcohol and try not to think about it and try and suppress it, or through abusing prescription drugs or just buying
a lot
of
stuff. There was one aspect of this that the government was saying that there is a threat from you. They were going, you know, a threat to Homeland Security. Are these Iraq and Afghanistan soldiers that are coming back, man, they don't love the U.S. government none too much. And they got training, and they're pissed, and they're hurting, and you got on the watch list on Moss. I'm going, okay, I don't know, what did you expect was going to happen? But, I mean, do you really see as a, I don't know if it would be a political block, it would be influence, it would be the Iraq soldiers and the Afghan soldiers and the soldiers of the war on terror coming back, is there a cauldron that's being added to? Is there something that's going to break here at home?
Certainly not that I'm aware of a large organized effort. I think
I don't think organized. I'm not looking for organized. That's not what I'm talking about. It's just an addition of just this animosity. You got all of a sudden this one guy goes off and this one guy goes off, and it just kind of affects it. It infects the culture.
Well, yeah, I mean, I certainly think that there have been effects, the PTSD and how that doesn't just stay with one individual. How it
post-traumatic stress syndrome, okay? Let people know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and that ripples beyond just one person, goes to their family and to their community. And have talked to some folks who work with former gang members, and in some inner cities where military recruitment is a lot of times focused on in inner cities, people who are trained in the military and sometimes deployed get back and then are returning to gangs with this new training that they have. And that's just tearing apart communities, too. So there's so many aspects and repercussions that, you think you send a bunch of people to a war and they do their job and come back. But yeah, like you said, there's so many after effects that a lot of
people... Did you see a lot of gang signs and graffiti and stuff? We keep getting reports that all of a sudden, you got L.A. gangs are in Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, there were some pieces of evidence of that going on. Well, yeah, I guess especially towards the end of when I was in, there was a crime ring operating on the military base that I was at that got busted. That sort of thing seemed to be increasing as I was in, and I think a lot of it has to do with, they need bodies, the military does, and the more they lower the standards to get people to go over there to fight, the more people they're going to let in with lower standards. And, yeah, a lot of times those are
gang members.
People involved, right.
You know, well, let's talk about the other gang members. You know, let's talk about the United States government. Let's talk about, you know, the private contractors. As from a soldier's perspective, when it used to be, I mean, when you went to war, you know, there were, like, soldiers there. Well, now it's like, what percentage did you think you kind of got the impression of the support structure, the private contractors, the mercenaries, all that? I mean, what kind of percentage was there in the theater you were in that you have that were military and non-military?
My experience actually was somewhat limited. We spent the majority of our deployment living in factory, an old factory in the poor industrial district of Baghdad, and spent most of our time there. So there were only a couple times when I actually saw armed contractors, and the only other ones that I really came in contact with.
So you spent most of your time with military people, right?
Correct.
Okay, so now as you're the chain of command, you're going up to how high? I mean, you had your, you know, your platoon sergeant. You had probably a lieutenant that you answered to. You have, you know, the command headquarters. Were they in that factory, or was it orders coming from somewhere else?
In the factory, the people that were living there, the highest rank would have been captain, and then from time to time, some higher ranking people would come out, and the highest ranking person who ever came out was General Ray Odierno.
And then when we come back, I want to hear about what your mission was. You're out on the front lines. I mean, you're away from the green zone. You know, you're out there in the community. You're kicking indoors. You got a factory little area there. You're out there doing business. And I want to know what that business was and why. What was your goal? You were there to accomplish what? But we'll find out when we come back with Josh Stiver in just a little bit.
Roads? It's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
Peace train sounding louder. Ride on the peace train.
Oh, the peace train. Well, it's not sounding louder from the government. It's louder from guys like Josh Stiver. You know, somebody that would just, you know, set aside their future to take the time to try and make up for the role that they believe that they had in this war and the pain that's caused. And, you know, and a lot of times I know people over there, they don't want you to feel less pain. They just soon you suffer more, I'm sure. And I'm glad you're doing it, and I'm sure it's for your own benefit and others. I mean, that's you're always motivated by what you perceive to be in your best interest, and not going crazy is always in your best interest. And part of that, there's enough humanity left in you to try and be humane. And I want to know the mission that was depicted in the Wiki video. Is that common practice? I mean, does that happen all the time, or was that a fluke?
I would say it reveals some pretty common trends. The actual mission that was going on was one that I'm pretty sure was unique to our unit. We had a lieutenant colonel who's been notorious for some other things that he's done, and he came up with this idea of sending people out for 12 to 14 hours at a time searching house to house. And most units would search houses, just not for that length of time. So we would, on a fairly regular basis, go out and just go door to door searching through people's houses for anything that looks suspicious. And that's what's going on in the video. And the folks in the helicopter were assigned to watch over the people going door to door. And based on the training I explained earlier, we were, you know, taught to shoot first and ask questions later if there was anything that looked like a threat. And they identified the men on the ground as a threat, and it actually did turn out that there were a few weapons on those men, and so they did what was expected of them based on the military training that we went through.
There were more than a couple of guys standing together. You had, I don't know, 8-10 people, and some of them were Reuters reporters, journalists, and they just lit them up. They go, hey, we got soldiers down there somewhere, and they're kind of within distance of, you know, boom, problem solved. And I really am surprised that Americans would think it would be any less. When you go to war, you're doing this door-to-door thing. I mean, what'd you think was going to happen? So I'm just, you know, why are we even there? I mean, you know, it's just, so I want to know what they're going door to door to door to door to search for what? What are you looking for? I mean, heck, you go to my house, you're going to have probably more weapons than what they have there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when I thought back to my history class learning about some of the reasons for the American Revolution, I remembered how the British soldiers treated American colonists was one of the main reasons, and seemed like some hypocrisy there. And yeah, that's what we were doing, was going through people's houses and sometimes, you know, occupying houses. And we'd look for weapons or excess amounts of money or something that might indicate that they were in a local militia or something like that.
And so what? They're in a local militia. They got, you know, three guns instead of one. They got, you know, $5,000 instead of five. They got, you know, and? I mean, you go, oop, gotcha. You know, it sounds like, you know, raids here. You know, it's turning into that here, and the civilians here. This is happening here. And I'm going, you know, wow. And then a lot of times you'll have law enforcement that they hire soldiers and ones that have urban combat training. You know, here we go. I'm like, wow, I'm afraid for us. And I'm wondering, you know, your brethren that you come out of the service with, a lot of them didn't ask for a conscientious objector status. A lot of them are going back for other tour. They don't feel at home here. They're not, you know, once you get to this level of, you know, intensity and constant awareness, and it can't not affect you. What kind of generation are we creating of young soldiers that are coming here? They're what? Most of them are going back? Or do they integrate into society fairly regularly? And it's just a few people that have problems? I mean, do you have any concept of how big the problem is or how it affects them?
I'd say it's one of the huge challenges that, yeah, we're facing at this time. And the reason it's such a big challenge for a lot of it is that in the military, we're constantly told, even as far back as basic training, even before we get into combat, that civilians who haven't been through even that training can't understand you, and that you're like a completely different type of species almost. Or that was an actual quote from a drill sergeant of mine, and some people buy into that and find civilians less and less easy to relate to. And then from the civilian side, there's still so many people who really don't want to be troubled with having to think about war and what's going on, and they just accept the storyline that we're over there spreading freedom and democracy or whatever, and think that you can't you know, have challenging conversations with soldiers. I mean, I think that soldiers need to be drawn out and asked questions. When I do it with soldiers I encounter, I try and do it in a respectful way, because I think that, you know, somewhere deep down they were trying to do something positive, and it just got twisted. But so you have this huge wall of soldiers being told that civilians don't understand them, and civilians being told that soldiers are protecting their freedoms, and there's not much room for discussion or for people to actually vent their frustrations in a system like that.
And or not that much accuracy either. So we have, you're on a mission out there to go door to door to accomplish, well, let's put it this way. What was accomplished? I mean, you made friends, you got rid of bad guys, you secured areas. I mean, were you actually doing anything of benefit?
No, it was kind of a self-propelling circle. There would be fairly regular attacks against us, usually from snipers or roadside bombs. And so people, you know, wanting to keep ourselves safe, we would go on raids and searches to try and find the people who were carrying these things out. And in the process of doing that, through ripping through people's homes and through a number of other things, only make more people upset at us and intensify things. And so, yeah, it was a self-propelling circle that in order to do what we were told we had to, we were making the situation that much worse. And,
well, did you realize that? I mean, didn't you? I mean, was this like a big revelation, or did it take time to learn it, or did you know it while you were doing it?
For me, Tokyo actually going there and, yeah, seeing that played out, I had a very kind of short-sighted image of it. I thought that there were, you know, a certain number of, you know, bad guys or whatever who were causing all the problems, and once you get rid of them, then everyone else can, you know, continue on and live happy lives. And, yeah, very short-sighted and idealistic, and took actually seeing the effect that it has on a civilian population to get me to see things differently.
Well, what kind of effect did it have? When a typical home that you would break in with a family, let's say they had, you know, a traditional family, you know, a husband, a wife, and one or more kids, you know, maybe a grandma, you know, you'd break in, and what would be the drill? Everybody on the floor, you know what? How many people would go in with you?
A lot of it depended on the situation. I guess a common example might be maybe five or six soldiers would go into a house, and you separate the men from the women and search all the men, and then search through all the different rooms. Was the typical drill. And yeah, it is a very dehumanizing thing. And I guess that's, one of the major, parts of my story too is, one of the things that even after I got back and had gone through, the conscientious objection process, I mentioned before that I, walked and biked across the country and actually was hosted by a man from Iraq. And that was a really powerful experience just to be able to sit down and talk to somebody from, you know, this country where I had had all these assumptions about and so many dehumanizing experiences, just to have that humanity restored through his kindness. And we ended up going on a tour together to try and talk about how people are not natural enemies.
Wow. I appreciate you coming on and taking the time to do what you're doing, but I'm trying to justify, is there any benefit whatsoever came out? I can't, you know, I knew going, I'm a libertarian, man. I get it. You know, it's a war is the health of the state. There's no benefit, certainly not for us. You know, it's for whoever that benefits from this stuff. But I'm trying to reconcile, you know, is there any common ground that you can find in a transition from U.S. getting out and leaving Iraq alone, or are they just better off just turning around and us just leaving them alone?
Well, for a long time, I kind of bought into the argument that, well, at the very least, we're there to play babysitter in case things get too bad. But the last couple weeks that I was in Iraq, things got horrible, and actually for 3 or 4 straight days, there was a lot of sectarian violence, and we didn't do anything. So we failed to even live up to our role of babysitter. And yeah, in my opinion, it would be better to leave altogether.
I am of that opinion. You know, I was of that opinion before we went in. But, you know, I appreciate, you know, you coming on. Josh Stieber, he's on a mission to regain his humanity and maybe show us that people in the Middle East are human also, and that we have a lot more in common if we just get all the governments out of the way. And I appreciate you coming on, and hopefully, how are you doing? Are you going to be okay?
Yeah, I really appreciate you having me on and talking about these important ideas and these challenging ideas.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Hopefully you get better, and I know it's a long process, but you're on the right road. We'll be right back.